To Perek Bet, Chapter 2. Once again, I want to thank Dana, Nila, and Rubenstein for dedicating the series for the year. And also, we link to this session specifically the following donations from our Day of Giving back in July. Shirley Osler, Simone and Jack Oziel, and Devorah and Howie Paskowitz. So, thank you very much. We started out chapter 2 by talking about the question of why Ahasuerus wants a new queen, whether it's because he remembers the beauty of Vashti, the difficulty of making that fit within the text. We offered the idea that he just mentioned her, and that led his aides to suggest, hey, wouldn't it be great to get a new queen? That was Ibn Ezra. We floated the idea from the Shlal David, Rabbi David Zinsheim, that it was that he remembered that she was killed unjustly, and we showed how that could fit the text. And lastly, we suggested this is all part of the satire. It's all part of seeing Ahasuerus as this Persian polygamist. We also had the idea that Maish pointed out that that Ahasuerus wants the power that comes with the search and selecting somebody who will be under his control, which fits other themes that we've mentioned. We talked more about that. We talked about the Medrash as well, about Ahasuerus actually executing the counselors who had told him to get rid of Vashti. And that was a piece of it as well. But then we moved into a discussion, which is really front and center today, about how the Book of Esther presents the Jews as a population in exile. And that's where we begin. And we said that that starts with the very first mention of Jews. In Perek Bet Pasuk Hei, Chapter 2, Sentence 5, we are introduced to the Jews by telling us that there's this Jewish man, or not Jewish man, that's already a mistake, Ish Yehudi, the man from Yehud, which we noted last week is Yehud is the name used in Daniel, it's used in Ezra, as the name for Judea. And he came to this, he came to live in Persia as part, or Bavel originally, as an exile. So right off the bat, we're introduced to the Jews as a nation of exiles. But more than that, we start off with Rebecca's question, with the tension about whether Mordechai and Esther want Esther to end up in the palace or not. How do we understand how Esther ends up in the palace? So in order to address this question, and we could just ask it off the top of our heads, hey, what do you think? Does she want to be there or not? But I prefer to go with something a little more rigorous. I think we should take a look at Chapter 2, Sentence 10. Perek Bet Pasuk Yud, in which we are told, Lohi Gida Esther Es Amah Ves Moladata. Esther does not share her nation. She does not share where she was born or the people from whom she was born. Because Mordechai told her, don't tell anybody. So the question fundamentally is, why not tell? Why are you keeping your heritage a secret? So one school of thought is Rashi's approach. If you take a look on the source sheets, hopefully everybody got them. I started now including a note in my emails. I don't think I did it for this class. I did it for my Shmuel one on Thursday, explaining how to download the sheet if you're having trouble. With a picture of the down arrow and all of that. So that will make it into this email I expect next week as well. But if you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, Rashi says, here's why Mordechai says not to tell. Kedei sheyomru shehi mimishpacha bizuya. So they'll say she must be from some lowly degraded family. Vishalchu, and they'll send her away. In other words, Esther wants to get out of the palace. So the easiest way to do that is have them think that she is unacceptable. That's the way we should do it. She is she's a persona non grata. We don't want her having anything to do with the king, and send her away. Tell them she tested positive for COVID. Something like that. That's the way to get.
How did you come to that conclusion?
I'm sorry? So Rashi, as a general rule, is not saying his own things. Rashi usually is quoting you a medrash. And this is an idea that appears in enough different places that I suspect it is coming from a midrashic root, although I can't show you where it is. I didn't see a medrash that says it, but this is it. It's a popular idea. And from a logical perspective, it makes sense for two reasons, one of which Rashi gives you. If you take a look at source number two still, look at the second half of what Rashi says. That tips you off about what the evidence is for this. He says, "She'im yed'u she'im mishpachat Shaul HaMelech hayu machzikim ba," because if they knew that she was from the family of Shaul, they would keep her. So what Rashi is doing here is he's telling you that she has something to hide. It's not a question of telling them, "I am a Jew," or not telling them, "I am a Jew." She's descended from Shaul. How does Rashi know she's descended from Shaul? Where did Rashi get that?
Maybe from Yishmini.
That's close.
It must be a medrash. It must be a medrash.
No, it's not. It's a pasuk.
Oh, it's right there.
It's right there in the pasuk. Chana is smiling. Go ahead. Sorry?
It tells you the pedigree of Mordechai.
Yeah.
Ben Kish.
Shaul, King Shaul, is Shaul ben Kish. So the thought is that Mordechai is a descendant of Shaul, and we know that Esther is his first cousin, right? Their fathers are brothers. So therefore, if he is from there, then she is from there. And Rashi is saying to you, this isn't a choice between saying Jewish or hiding being Jewish. She has royal pedigree. Why wouldn't she say, Ruchama Rakshniya, why wouldn't she say that she is royal? It must be because if you say you're royalty, then you're more desirable. She wants to be undesirable. That's one piece of evidence. The second piece of evidence has nothing to do with the text, but simply what nice Jewish girl would want to be with Ahasuerus, this horrible human being. Ahasuerus is, to quote Yoram Hazoni in The Dawn, Ahasuerus is a serial rapist. He is having all these women brought to him from around the kingdom, each one day after day after day, to be consigned afterwards to his harem. They're never going to get married. They're never going home. He's a horrible, why would she want to be there? So Rashi says, number one, you're concealing royal heritage. Number two, the alternative is going to Ahasuerus? There's no way she wants to be there. It must be hide her identity so that she won't become queen. Ruchama. So Ruchama, hang on.
If we look at the verse 3, that's what he asked them to look. To look for a betulah and na'arayafah. That's what is important to him.
Right. So Ruchama suggests that actually such a strategy could backfire. Because in fact, what Ahasuerus wants is just, as you say here, betulah yafah is what his assistants, what his servants said. It's not what Ahasuerus said. But it does indeed backfire because she gets selected.
No, in Pasuk 3 it's written,
yeah.
Nachon,
אבל זה היה בעצת המשרתים. זה לא היה דבר שהוא בדע מעצמו. זו הייתה עצתם. מכל מקום, עצתם קיבלה אכן בעיניו. מצא אכן בעיניו, נכון? הוא הסכים. But Janine, hang on one second. The truth of the matter is that this does backfire. If that's what they're trying to do to keep her away, it doesn't work. But that's one way to look at the strategy that's going on here. Janine.
Well, he was trying to replace another daughter of a king, another royal woman. So this would have been a plus for him, besides everything else, her beauty or whatever. But would have been a feather in it.
Assuming he wanted that. Remember, we talked about the possibility that he Davka wants. He specifically wants somebody who does not have that background, somebody who can't challenge him. So again, we do this all the time. We come up with strategies. We have these great ideas. And sometimes they work. And sometimes they're a bust. That's the way it goes. Achashverosh here is, yeah, Achashverosh. Mordechai and Esther are trying to do something, and maybe it works, and maybe it doesn't work. I have way more to say about this. I see two notes in the chat, and Moish has his hand up. But there's so much more to say. We've only seen one fragment of one point of view. So I'm going to address the two chat notes very fast, and then we're going to see more about this. Otherwise, we'll be in chapter 2 forever, and Susan will laugh at me for the rest of the year for thinking we're doing more than Esther this year. So, number one, maybe she doesn't want to be Vashti, number two, and be killed. I think that's a valid reason also not to want to become queen. Aside from the horror of being Ahasuerus's wife, do you really want to be vulnerable to his whims and moods when he's drunk? So I think that's a fair point that Leah makes. And then the other is Jules and Carla, right? He may also be in search of a new queen, not another harem member. He also will need an heir, and that's a fair point. Nonetheless, he picks the one who doesn't have any sort of heritage. Moish, I'm going to hold your question until I get to go through this in general, because there's so much to say here. Ibn Ezra has a very interesting idea about this, and it doesn't seem like Ibn Ezra. This doesn't sound like something Ibn Ezra would usually say. He says they're actually concealing her identity because she wants to be able to live as a Jew in the palace. And once you tell them you're a Jew, they start watching what you're doing. And they recognize that you're doing it as part of your Judaism, and that's not going to be acceptable to them. Where he gets this from is very unclear to me. It's certainly not straight text. But take a look at source number 3. He says, Yesh omrim ki Mordechai lo asa nechona. Some say that what Mordechai did was actually incorrect. Incorrect in the sense that, watch what he says, the Shetzival Esther Shalota Girima Kipachad Shaloyikachena Hamelch Lisham Yedashi Mehagola. He says some suggest that Mordechai says that she shouldn't speak up because he's afraid that if she says she is from the diaspora, Achashverosh won't want to marry her. In other words, she's concealing a negative heritage, not a positive heritage. And I'm going to come back to that idea. That's not Ibn Ezra's core idea that we're getting to. He mentions that idea.
I'm going to come back to this idea. I'm not defending it or discussing it yet.
He has a second idea. He says some say he wants her to become queen, specifically so that she will end up bringing rescue to Israel. Again, I'm not dealing with that answer because he rejects it. We're going to come back to that answer. I want to get to what Ibn Ezra does choose for himself. Vanachon be'enai. It appears good in my eyes. Ki asa zem Mordechai ba'avur shetishmor Torat Hashem b'seter. He does this that she can keep Judaism in private. Shalot ochal nevelot, so that she won't eat treif. V'tishmor shabbatot, she can keep Shabbos. V'lo yagishu ha'mishartim, and no one's going to notice because they're not on the lookout for it. Ki im yivada davar, if it were known, shema ha'melech yachrichena, maybe the king would compel her to violate Judaism. Oh, Yahargena, or he would kill her. Kibal korchanit b'sa. Remember, she's taken there against her will. So Ibn Ezra throws you this idea after first mentioning two other ideas that he rejects. He throws you this idea that the goal is for her to be able to practice Judaism, and therefore you have to keep things on the down low. They can't be aware. So far I have Rashi, who says she's concealing a positive heritage so that she will be considered unworthy. By the way, I couldn't get a word in edgewise to say it before, so I'll say it now. There are actually those who contend that neither Mordechai nor Esther are from Shaul. Because if you look at the lineage, back in sentence 6, it says that he is the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish of Binyamin. Clearly, we didn't list every member of the family line, right? Meaning, Kish, if this is indeed Kish, the father of Shaul, you're talking about somebody who lived at minimum 500 years before Mordechai. You're not telling me that this is Mordechai is the great-grandson of someone 500 years earlier. Yes, we have such concepts, but we don't apply them here. Rather, it's listing some people who were known to us. Well, if one of the people in the line was Shaul, he would qualify as known, more so than his father Kish. So his father Kish is wonderful, he's a gibor, but he's not Shaul. So there are those who argue that actually Mordechai is some kind of a nephew. He's not part of the line, and therefore Esther also is not a direct part of the line coming from Shaul. That's just a side note. But Rashi says they're concealing a positive heritage in order to avoid her becoming queen. Ibn Ezra says what she's concealing is her Judaism, so that she'll be able to practice Judaism even if she's stuck in the palace or in the harem. And then you get the other view. And the other view is the view that Ibn Ezra rejected already. It's the view that says that actually Mordechai wants her to be selected as queen, which Ibn Ezra views as a bad thing to want. But he wants her to be queen, and what he's actually concealing is galut. He's concealing the fact that they come from the Jews who were exiled. So Rebecca asked the question, in terms of why we would label it the Gola. Gola does not mean a place, the way we use the term Gola to mean the diaspora. Gola means those Jews who were exiled. That's the use of the term. Yes, Rebecca. Well, there are no Jews from Shushan. There are no Jews from Shushan. There are only Jews from the diaspora.
Exactly. So why use that term rather than saying he doesn't want...
It's the fact that it's a refugee population. That's what makes them undesirable. It's a refugee population with all the overtones that that brings with it in our day. That's the way they're looked at. Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar, in his Or HaChaim commentary to Megillah, well, it's not Or HaChaim, actually. Or HaChaim is his commentary to the Chumash. His commentary to Esther is called Rishon LeTzion, offers us this idea. He says, and here, because it's a long text, I'm just going to read my English translation aloud, and Moshe, I still see your hand. I will get back to you. He says, it appears that two reasons compelled Mordechai to instruct Esther not to say anything. First, when he saw that Esther was taken by the empire, and it is known that Israel at that time were captives, right, shvuyim, and of low esteem, kalei ha'erech, they were not valued, Mordechai was concerned for Esther's honor that she not be degraded in the eyes of Ahasuerus because of her low status as part of the captivity. But her low status would not prevent Esther from doing, it should be Ahasuerus, sorry, I was translating too quickly. It would not have prevented Ahasuerus from doing as he lusted with her due to her beauty, meaning Ahasuerus is still going to take her, but he wouldn't marry her because of the low status of her nation. And he quotes you a passage in the Gemara that talks about what you can assume happens when people take captives. The Talmud says of Esther that she knew Ahasuerus would not marry her because she would not be suited for monarchy. Therefore, in other words, let me just take a step back and explain the logic. Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar is arguing that Ahasuerus is taking her in terms of using her either way. Whether she is an exile, a refugee, or whether she is a noble isn't going to make a difference to him. As Ruchama said before, Narod betulot tovot mare. The pedigree doesn't matter at that stage. So Mordechai says, look, she is going to be taken anyway to Ahasuerus. And he's going to do what he's going to do. And there's absolutely nothing I can do to prevent that from happening. But if she has to go there anyway, at least let her go there as a queen. And so he continues and says, therefore, he instructed her not to tell, For even Achashverosh would take her for relations. She would not remain in this low position. Especially within the words of the sages that Achashverosh hated Israel. That's Midrash, that Achashverosh doesn't like us to begin with. It is obvious that he would not make her the queen and would not place the crown of monarchy upon her head. Whether Achashverosh liked us or not, we'll get to in chapter 3, God willing. But he's not going to make her the queen. He's not going to give her monarchy if he thinks that she's a Jew. So therefore, conceal that you're a Jew. Conceal that you're a refugee, certainly, and maybe you can become queen. And then he continues to say, it's not just making the best of a bad deal. You have to go to the palace anyway, better to go as a queen. But also, you may end up being useful. He says, I also say that Mordechai knew well that Esther was not taken to the palace for nothing. And here he's quoting you a medrash, by the way. He doesn't say it, but it's actually a medrash found in a couple of different places. For Mordechai knew the righteousness of this righteous woman, and God forbid that God should bring her to this, other than for a great need, as developed in the end. As he said to her, who knows if for a time like this, you arrived in the monarchy. Therefore, he strategized, telling her not to tell for that reason. So that Mordechai wants her to conceal it, figuring, number one, this way she avoids being just a woman in the harem. And number two, she'll be in a position to help us. So he says, don't tell your negative heritage. And then finally, and then I see some hands, he says, second, Mordechai wished to hide his relationship with Esther so that he would know what was done with her. Meaning, he doesn't want them to know that she is related to him, because if that happens, they conceal information from family. So this way, he's figuring, I can pick up whatever news I can, rumors, whatever, outside of where the women are being held. Okay, so to sum up what we've said, Rashi says you're hiding good heritage in order to avoid getting picked. Ibn Ezra says you're hiding your identity as a Jew to enable you to practice Judaism, and as Toby notes in the chat, you may have to do that for a very long time. That seems a little difficult. And Rabbi Chayyim ibn Attar, as well as the first view quoted in Ibn Ezra, says no. Achashverosh isn't going to marry an exile. He's just going to use her and stick her in the harem. So better to hide your negative background and hope that that will help you to become queen, so that at least you have queen status and not harem status, and so that you might be able to help the Jews in general. Those are the two benefits that Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar identifies here. Moshe, you waited for a very long time. I can't see you and I can't hear you. Don't know. Okay, next. There were a few others. Susan. Susan, you're muted.
In my explanation, it talks about Mordechai's heritage, and I don't understand one thing of what it says. May I ask you about it?
I guess. So that's on the Judah versus Benjamin issue. I'm going to leave that out because that takes us too far afield.
The other one is that Mordechai had done something really bad, and they blamed the tribe of Judah, the Jew of the tribe.
Right. Again, I'm really sticking away from that. We discussed a little bit last week about how to resolve Ish Yehudi versus Ish Yemini. But like I said when we started the series, we can't touch on every point within this, or we will literally never get anywhere. The Megillah has so many things to talk about. So, if you want to email me about it, I'll be glad to clarify by email. I just don't want to use the time right now in the middle. Moshe has his hand back up. So, Moshe, you ready for us?
I hope so. Yep, I'm ready. Okay, I'm going to try to give you an entirely different perspective of what's going on. First of all, you have to think of Sefer as as a piece of art. And the reason I say that is because it's all about different perspectives. I mentioned the last time that the first two, three prakim are all about the Persian perspective. And that's the essence of what's going on in here. But hidden under here is the beginning of the Jewish perspective. Mordechai, who was the only Jew who was living in Shushan HaBira and was not known to be a Jew, sends Esther at her agreement because he has a very strong suspicion that something terrible is about to happen. And Esther agrees. And just bear with me, it's not going to be long. Rebecca just nailed the coffin for me. That's why it says Hagolah. These were, they weren't refugees. They were survivors. It's like my father-in-law said, it's going to happen here again. They had a complete sensitivity to what was going on. And now you see, how important that it is. It doesn't say Yashav. Yoshev, he was sitting there all the time. He was listening to all the anti-Semitism that was going on in Shushan HaBira, and he said to himself, we got to do something to stop this. And whether she's going to become the queen or in the harem, which was not as bad as you might think. There were a lot of benefits in that, real benefits. It would be one off or all off. It would just make God's work that much quicker. That's the story. And that's why a lot of Chazal can't go along with that. How do you put a Jewish woman in such a situation? Nevertheless, when you're just, they say that Mordechai was part of the Akinash Sekhtar, or was a Navi.
Moish.
Okay, I've done it.
Thanks. So Moshe is agreeing with Reb Chaim ibn Attar, effectively, and saying that he saw there being a function to this. He's adding in the bit about coming from the exile and being sensitive to this, which is entirely possible, and it will fit with some of the other things that we're going to talk about. But whatever way we read the motivation here, fundamentally, and this is the point that I wanted to highlight out of this piece of things of not telling her identity, Mordechai and Esther are reacting to being a nation in exile. Whether you take Rashi's approach, which is you're in exile, stay away from the government. You don't want them to know you. You want to be quiet and fly under the radar. That's Rashi's read. Or whether you take Ibn Ezra's view, which is protect your ability to follow your religion, again, by making sure they don't know what your religion is. The less they know about you, the better off you are. That's Ibn Ezra. Or the position of Rav Chaim ibn Attar, which is look for a way to protect your people. All of these are exile mentalities. Whether you take Rashi, Ibn Ezra, or the Rechaim, whether you're being protective or whether you're being adventurous, these are all elements of the Jews seeing themselves as vulnerable. It's only a question of what you're trying to protect and how you're trying to protect it. But there's more. There's more to be said here regarding this vulnerability and regarding the exile state. And here we get to a question which everybody asks regarding the book of Esther. I already alluded to it last week. And that is the question of the names Mordechai and Esther. I gave you the links again in source number 5 for anyone who didn't get a chance to look at it last week. The problem fundamentally is that these are the names of a Mesopotamian god and goddess. Whether Assyrian, whether Babylonian, Marduk is supposed to be a god of war, Ishtar is a goddess of love/war, and even though in the Megillah we mention that Esther has another name, she is also named Hadassah, we never use it. We mention it in order not to use it. So the question that you have to ask is, why are the heroes of a Jewish story named for Mesopotamian gods? So some have argued, I think very, very unconvincingly, that this shows assimilation. I think that's a really hard sell. First of all, you know that it's not assimilation to the Persians because these aren't Persian gods. They're Babylonian gods. They're Assyrian gods. They're not Persian gods. And while it's true that the Babylonians take on Assyrian gods, and you see the Persian king Cyrus invoke Baal, which is Babylonian, we don't find Ishtar and Marduk associated with the Persians. That's number one. So I think it's difficult to make that argument. Number two, and more fundamentally, if you look in an unvarnished way at how Mordechai is presented in the Megillah, he is presented as a religious figure. He's not presented as an assimilated figure. Certainly that's why our sages believe that we're supposed to look at Mordechai. If you take a look at source number 6, I gave you an important reference to a pasuk in Ezra. Take a look, please, at Ezra chapter 2, sentence 2. If you're using a Tanakh to look at Esther, you just want to keep on going in the Tanakh towards the end until you get to the book of Ezra and then stop. Chapter 2, sentence 2. This is from a census of the Jews who return in the initial wave to Israel under the Persians with Zerubbabel. And in chapter 2, sentence 2, we are told, those who came with Zerubbabel were Yeshua, Nehemiah, Seraiah, Re'eliah, Mordechai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigvai, Rechum, Ba'ana, Mispar, dot. Bunch of names, including the name Mordechai. And our sages understood that this is indeed the same Mordechai. Then how did he get back to Persia? We'll talk about that. We have to address that question. But take a look at source number 7, where the Talmud makes hay out of this idea. It asks the question of how Mordechai knew about the plot of Bigtan and Teresh against Achashverosh. They read that verse that we just read in Ezra as referring not to Mordechai, but to Mordechai Bilshan. And they take the word Bilshan and say, that's a really interesting word. Anybody know what a Balshan is in Hebrew? Nachon. Oh. So, not necessarily. It can be from Lashon, or it can be from Livlosh. Livlosh, to be Bolesh, is to investigate. A Balshan, as I understand it, is a detective. So they read this Mordechai Bilshan. Sorry, Chana?
Just because I'm
a linguist. Yeah. Either from Lashon, a linguist, or from Livlosh, as somebody who seeks and investigates. But either way, they say it's actually an adjective describing Mordechai. Because the Sanhedrin, the high court, and Mordechai as somebody who walking with Zerubbabel would have to be somebody of quite a great stature. So the Sanhedrin has to be able to hear people testify in any language and understand what they're saying. So they say that's what Mordechai does. And therefore, as I brought you from the Gemara and Megillah in source number 7, Mordechai was able to understand the special speech of Bigtan and Teresh, and that's how he knew about their plot. They spoke and didn't realize that they could be overheard. So that's number one, that in general, we understood him to be this high spiritual religious figure. He's on the Sanhedrin. But there's more evidence of who Mordechai is. There was a 19th century maskil by the name of Yitzchak Shmuel Reggio who argued that Mordechai was not knowledgeable of Torah. And I even saw that the website alatorah.org claims that Rabbi Yaakov Meidan argued that Mordechai starts out in the Megillah not observant and that he grows into it. But it doesn't fit. Take a look at source number 8. I gave you a reference there to a verse from Malachim Bet, Kings 2. This is a very important passage. Kings 2, chapter 24. It's the end of Kings 2. This is describing Babylonian conquest and specifically the exile that Mordechai is associated with. So it's chapter 24, sentences 11 to 15. In comes Nebuchadrezzar, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He lays siege to Jerusalem. Jehoiachin, the king of Judea, comes out to him, along with his mother, along with his servants, along with his nobles, and the king of Babel takes him, Nebuchadnezzar takes him into exile. It's the eighth year of his reign. And he takes all the stores, and he takes all the gold implements that that Shlomo had made, and he exiles them. And specifically, who does he exile? Sentence 14, all of Jerusalem, all of the nobles, all of the mighty people of substance. That's who he takes into exile. That's the exile where Mordechai goes, because the Megillah tells us in chapter 2, sentence 6, that he was exiled with Yechoniah Melech Yehuda. That is this exile. Yehoiachin and Yehoiachin are the same person. Don't get confused. It's one of those things that happens. So the what you're seeing there, and hopefully this will clarify where we're going with this, is that Mordechai is a man of status. He goes into exile with the leadership of Jerusalem, those who are the muckety mucks, so to speak. He's not somebody of low standing. And then you see him in the Megillah in chapter 3, refusing to bow to Haman. Refusing to bow to Haman was not unique to Mordechai. Who else within this exile refused to bow in Tanakh?
Daniel.
Not Daniel. He wasn't in that story, but you're close. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Daniel's friends. Daniel seems to be out of town for that story. But Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refuse to bow as well. They get thrown into a fiery furnace, and they merit to be saved via miracle. Mordechai is in very good company. But not just that. Why does Haman want to destroy the Jews? It's Mordechai who is not bowing to him. What does the Megillah say? Why does Haman want to destroy the Jews? Because Mordechai told them, Asher hu Yehudi. Mordechai is straight up honest about who he is. He doesn't deny being from Yehud. In other words, if you're going to argue that Mordechai is some assimilated person in that society, you're dealing with somebody who, number one, was part of the nobility, the higher-ups, when they went into exile, possibly went back with Zerubbabel among the leadership to Israel. He identifies explicitly as a Jew from Yehud, the Hood, you might say. He refuses to bow, like Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And what is his reaction when he finds out about the decree of Haman, the decree that all the Jews should be killed? How does Mordechai respond? First, he does the whole sackcloth and ashes thing, right? But then what's the strategy that Esther comes up with? What should they do?
Fasting. A religious.
It's a religious response. They fast for 3 days, right? They fast for 3 days. So I read somebody who said, I thought this was very funny, that maybe this fast is not a religious thing because it doesn't say they prayed. Apparently they went on a weight loss program. They want to kill us, so I guess we should go on a weight loss program. We're going to go on a diet for 3 days. That doesn't make any sense. But what's worse is that it displays ignorance of the book. This is the problem when people don't read to the end. I understand the end of the Megillah is not as exciting as the beginning of the Megillah. But take a look at chapter 9, sentence 31 in Megillat Esther. Talks about the Purim celebration. L'kayem es yemei ha-Purim ha-ele, to uphold these days of Purim bizmanehem, in their times. Kasher kiyam aleihem Mordechai Yehudi v'Esther Malka, as Mordechai and Esther established them, dot, dot, dot. Divrei hatzomot v'za'akatam. the days of their fasting and their pleading, their crying out. In other words, they did pray. You just have to read the rest of the Megillah. So the so I think it's extremely difficult to read Mordechai as somebody who was assimilated in order to explain why he has the name of a Babylonian god. I have a problem with the name, but that's not the resolution. It just is inconsistent with the book. Parenthetically, Carla asks in the chat, wouldn't that make Mordechai exceedingly old if he's really from that original exile? So we actually talked about that in the, I think in the introductory class. We dealt with the timelines. I'd ask you to go back to the recording, but basically we floated a couple of ideas. One possibility is that he's a descendant of. He's not himself one of those who actually went into the exile. But go back to the recording there. We did talk that through. So, okay. Why do they have names then of Babylonian gods? What is this? How do we understand that? Carly, you can't write things like that because then you jump the gun on me. I'm getting to it. So our sages are bothered by this point. They're very bothered by these names because Mordechai and Esther are religious figures. So you get this Gemara in Chulin, which I thought I brought you on the sheet, but I see that I did not. I thought I had. It's in Chulin Lametesim at Bayes 39b. Oh, you know what? I did. I brought you the Gemara in Megillah, which is parallel to the one in Chulin. That's why. Take a look at source number 9. The Gemara here is commenting on a pasuk in Yeshaya, a verse in Isaiah. Tachas hana'atzutz ya'aleh v'rosh v'sachas hasirpad ya'aleh hadas. It's a prediction. In the future, instead of thorns, a cypress will ascend. In place of nettles, a myrtle will ascend. And the part that's relevant for us is, in place of thorns means in place of Haman, the thorn. And what will come up in his place is a cypress. Cypress, in Hebrew, is Barosh. So what? How is the Barosh a reference to Mordechai? Because Mordechai is called Rosh. How is Mordechai called Rosh? Because the name Mordechai can be read as a compound of Mara Dachya, or Mere Dechi, as it's rendered here in the Gemara. Mare Dechi can be a statement of, or can be a term meaning the master of this, Mare Dechi, or Mara Dachya is that it is bitter and pure. However you read it, it is the Aramaic for a spice in the incense called Mor Dror. You're going to get confused here. Susan, your hands are on your head, and I can tell you that they will be for a little bit. But don't worry, in the end it'll make sense. What this Gemara in source number 9 is saying is that the name Mordechai is actually the Aramaic of a spice called Mor Doror that's used in the incense. And the spices are called Besamim Rosh, and that's like Berosh. I'm not going into all the language here. It's not the point. The point that is relevant here, and what they're doing, what the Gemara is doing, is it's trying to Hebraicize or Judaize Mordechai's name. It's not Marduk. It's Maradachia. It's not a Babylonian or Assyrian god. It's actually a beautiful spice that's part of the incense. It's a way to reconcile the problem, but it's a little bit of a reach. I mean, if you don't do the whole Barosh thing, it's less of a reach. Just say, Mordechai is Maradachia, which makes sense because they spoke Aramaic. It's Aramaic for this spice. And you want to name your kid for a spice, especially a spice that's in the Ketoret. But I think the answer is much more simple, and Carla said the same thing as I did in the chat, so that gives me some chizuk here. I can really feel like what I'm saying makes sense because Carla said it too, which is the Babylonians renamed the Jewish exiles with names that related to their religion. Take a look on your sheet at source number 10, and you will see a reference that I gave you there to the book of Daniel. So if you're, again, using your Tanakh to look at Esther, just go a little bit ahead, and you will see the next book, or maybe it depends on exactly how they arranged it, but it could be the next book, is indeed the book of Daniel. And in chapter 1, sentence 7, you read about Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah who are taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar, just like Mordechai was taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar. And what did the king do, among other things? Vayasem lahem sar hasarisim shemot. The officer in charge gave them names. Vayasem l'Daniel Belteshazzar. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar. And Hananiah became Shadrach. And Mishael became Meshach. And Azariah became Aved Nego. But those aren't just any names. Those are specific names. They're not random. It's not just like, hey, let's take a jumble of syllables. These names have meaning. We don't know exactly for all of them. Shadrach, for example, has a lot of debate. But Belteshazzar, we know exactly what it refers to. Baal is a Babylonian god. Shatzar is to protect. Baal the protector. Aved Nego, servant of Nego. Nego or Nebo was a Babylonian god. Shadrach and Meshach are harder to work with. But these were references to the Babylonian gods. Now, what's the common denominator between the names Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? What's the common denominator between all of them?
They have God's name.
They have God's name. The Jewish God's name. Their names have Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. So the Babylonians say, we are going to take these Jewish names that have their God as part of them, and we are going to convert them to names that have our deities in them. And I think that's what happens to Mordechai and to Esther. They had some original name. Mordechai's name is lost to us. I have no idea what it was. With Esther, we actually get her other name of Hadassah. But they've been given the names Marduk and Ishtar, and that's what they go by. To me, that's simple pshat in this. And once again, it highlights our theme, the Jews as an exile population. We have a lot of evidence building up the Jews as exiles now. So let me see if I can just make what we've said clear, because I rushed a little bit with this because I wanted to make sure we would get all of this in and not have it bleed from one session into the next. So let's see what we have here. Number one, we are introduced as exiles. Mordechai is, from the beginning, a man from Yehud. Yehud being Judea. Mordechai and Esther hide her lineage. And the motivation of hiding that lineage is an exile motivation. Either keep yourself away from all of those people, keep yourself away from the government. As the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Al titvada l'rashut, don't make yourself known to the government. Or, Ibn Ezra, the less they know about you, the better. Don't tell them who you are, and maybe you can get away with observing your Judaism. Or Rav Chaim ibn Attar, and the first idea presented in Ibn Ezra, which is, we need to find an advantage. Maybe, as Moish suggested, they're really sensitive because they are refugees, and they know that things aren't going to be good for the Jews there, and they're looking for some position, some way to have some kind of power. However you read it, this is a vulnerable population doing its best to survive. And then finally, our big righteous heroes have the names of Babylonian gods. Their names have been changed. By the way, just to clarify, they were exiled originally by the Babylonians. They're now among the Persians. I mentioned before, and I think I might have caused some confusion by pointing out, these names aren't Persian gods, they're Babylonian gods. They come into exile under the Babylonians originally. That, my point was only that this didn't represent assimilation into Persian society. So the message that comes out of this, and I see your hand, Moish, the message that comes out of this is that this is a book with messages for the reader who is in exile, who is in Galut. The book is establishing its bona fides for us. It's saying, you, the reader, who are living outside of the land, this one's for you. This is a story that you'll be able to relate to and that will carry messages for you. Now, I had wanted to start on the next point because Mordechai does something odd here. He hangs out at the king's gate, but we're not there yet. I'm going to take Moshe's comment or question first on what we just said, and then if we have a minute left, then we'll go into Mordechai at the king's gate. Yes.
You've just explained something I have never understood, and nobody has ever explained.
Okay.
So,
Maish, don't go to the 10th parak yet, because I have some wonderful things I want to say about the 10th parak, but only after we've done the 9th.
It's not about the 10th parak, it's about this. It says, Vayasem Abel Achayosh Perosh Mas. You want to put a tax on? You got to know my name. That's why I have a sin number. No, I'm not joking. That's for sure how they did it. They didn't start Jewish nation. Fine. You know, it's like when our grandparents came from Europe to Canada. They took their Jewish names, and they made something out of it. The customs officers in Halifax.
Right. So we'll talk more about it. I hear what you're saying. Yes, Susan.
I'm just a little confused with all of this. But how long was the Babylonian exile? Isn't this much later if they're already in Persia? So how did he have the name of the Babylonian if it's longer?
So the Babylonian exile is 70 years. That's the period that we're taught is the Babylonian exile. Unclear, as we've noted earlier, unclear when exactly it starts and whether Mordechai is exiled at the start of it or before it or after it. The 70 years have already begun. That depends on how we understand the calculation of the 70 years. But it's a 70-year exile.
So we're saying Mordechai moved from Babylonia, where he got this name, to Persia.
No. The Persians conquer Babylon. The Persians conquer Babylon.
So he stays where he is, but kept the name of the Babylonians.
So maybe he stayed where he was. This is part of where we're going next. Shushan was the site of the winter palace of the Persian Empire. This is where the king spent his time in the winter. It's possible that Mordechai lived there in general. It's also possible that Mordechai went there specifically because he wanted to be near the palace. And so there's more to talk about next week about this question of what Mordechai is doing in Shushan. So that's going to be next week.
I used to think Esther was simple. Now you've made it more complicated than I ever think.
Well, that's my job. So... What we're accomplishing here and hopefully understanding is the role of the book as an introduction to life in Galut, as an introduction to life in exile. That's what we're seeing here. And it's established very clearly before Haman ever shows up on the scene. So I'm just going to take a moment to introduce where we're going next with this, and we'll pick up with it next week. Mordechai spends almost the entire book in one place. And that is what we just mentioned. The Sha'ar HaMelech, the King's Gate. If you take a look at source number 11, right, where I wrote GPS, this is our location service for Mordechai. So the first reference there, chapter 2, sentence 11, is when Mordechai is at Chatzar Beit Hanashim. He's at the yard where the area where the women are kept. He was keeping tabs on Esther's situation. In each of the other references, twice in chapter 2, once in chapter 4, once in chapter 5, and once in chapter 6, he is at Sha'ar HaMelech, the king's gate. And the question that we're going to have to ask is, what is Mordechai doing there? How do we understand Mordechai being there? Does this indicate he's in a position of power? How would you square that with being in exile? So we're going to see different points of view as to what Mordechai is doing at the gate. And then the last thing that I'm going to want to deal with in chapter 2 is the classic medrash about Esther eating seeds in the palace and where that comes from and why that's so interesting, besides the fact that it's the source of our practice of eating hamantashen. That's part of our question, which we will get to, Ruchama. That's part of our question, is the fact that in Tanakh, it looks like it's Daniel doing it and not Esther. And that's part of why I want to discuss that and ask that question. If you want to jump the gun properly, you should take a look at source number 19, because that, I think, will help you to really jump the gun. But otherwise, we can see it next week. So looking forward, I just want to note, I think there are some people who are here who actually are not getting the emails. I see at least one name, if not more, that are not on the email list. So please make sure to email Rebecca to be able to... Oh, okay. Oh, okay, good. Because I want to make sure that people get the source sheets without it. Okay. Yeah, no, I just put Rebecca's email in the chat. So anybody who wants to be on that email list, please sorry? Anybody who wants to should please email her. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Touching your was great.